Major funding for soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Above and below the streets of modern France, two conversations this week on soundings. First, a discussion with Patricia O'Brien of the University of California at Irvine about her study of the police in 19th century France. Following that, a conversation with Donald Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill about his social history of France since 1880. Here is Patricia O'Brien.
To me, the interesting fact of 18th century France is that France had a policing system of municipal and rural policing that was considered to be the best in the world. Mm-hmm. It was the marvel of other European states. England sent observers to study the French police.
Now, this is before the Revolution.
Before the Revolution, yes. In fact, Louis XIV is responsible with the creation of the Lieutenant General of Police for really creating a centralized structure in the city of Paris, which then became a model for other cities in France.
Mm-hmm.
The problem here is that France also experienced the greatest social and political upheaval of any European state at the end of the 18th century. Within the Reign of Terror, which was a period where the state, in fact, ruled dictatorially, it was also the high point of the statement of the democratic principles of the revolution. And those kinds of tensions are the ones that got me interested in the police as a historical problem. The French Revolution put forward a new concept of law and a new concept of property, and that was really codified during the Napoleonic period. The changes in the French state required a new kind of police structure, one that was very much built upon what had been done in the 18th century mm-hmm. and had been done by Louis XIV at the end of the 17th. And that really was an attempt to create a police force, an independent police force that was not associated with a class,
mm-hmm.
that is defending the interests of the aristocracy, or a king defending the police in the old regime. While Louis XIV said, "I am under the authority of the police,"
right.
and he intended that the monarch would be protected by the police and served by the police, he was very much the one who was benefiting from the existence of the police. The police was created to protect the state, to
mm-hmm.
protect the monarch, since they were, in fact, the same. What you have in the 19th century, working out the problems of the revolution, this vacuum in power, is that a police must now be created to protect and defend law.
And well, the citizenry, and at one level, you're shifting, you know, again, from royalty to the population, for lack of a better term.
Yes, exactly right. You've struck on an essential point in my own research, is the shift in the legitimating factor from the monarch to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the police now, as an institution of the state, that is a legitimating institution for the state. Traditional histories of the police argue that it is an indication of the extension of the state into daily life in a very positive way.
Mm-hmm.
That is, ideas of law and order become standardized, that criminality is contained, that life in urban areas is made safe
mm-hmm.
with the growth of the police. I see it in a different way, not that it's good or bad, but I see that, in fact, the growth of the police coincides with the internalization of values by a general population. So a system of law, a new idea of property, and I think that's not claiming too much for the Napoleonic Code in 1800, that there is a new concept of property that moves away from aristocratic privilege and corporate ideas mm-hmm. to a modern concept of private property. That the police certainly are enforcing that, and by the end of the century, all the statistical indications are that they succeed. But in fact, it's the point at which that they're succeeding that other things have happened in the society mm-hmm. To work toward a system of law and order.
Do you look, for example, Pat O'Brien, when you investigate what you call policing structures in modern French history, are you looking at individuals? Are you looking at social forces? How do you tease out the causal elements in this description?
Yes, you've struck on one of the main problems of the project, I think.
Figuring out who did it.
Well, yes, exactly, because the police, I think, is so central mm-hmm. to a new culture that is emerging in the 19th century that very many aspects of this culture, I think, tell us something about policing, and vice versa. Policing can tell us something about the political culture, the climate of the time. So I am looking at educators, I am looking at reformers, I am looking at police officials, obviously, mm-hmm. But I'm also looking at revolutionaries and what their concept of law and order is in the first half of the 19th century. The locus of the revolution was Paris, and so that has been a problem, I think, in understanding the revolution, that often we only look at Paris to understand what happened in terms of a national transformation. In the first part of the 19th century, the idea that the revolution is over in 1799 is a completely false one, because what we see happening throughout the first half, well, I would say throughout all of the 19th century, is a working out of the problems that the revolution attempted to address, and that necessarily meant periods of revolutionary upheaval that repeated themselves, mm-hmm. whether it be 1830 or 1848 or 1870, 71. But there are also these stages along the way of riots and protest and collective action that at times appeared to lead to revolution, or might lead to revolution, that created great social unrest.
Mm-hmm. Pat O'Brien, tell me this, put you on thin ice for a social historian. Does your investigation into what you call policing structures in modern French history, does that have any analogy, or do you find parallels in looking about an American society in the 1980s? What the police represent, the assumptions behind policing structures, that sort of thing.
I think we've come full circle in a way. I'm speaking now as a participant in this society and not as a specialist of it, but in the United States in the late 1980s, we are looking at a situation in our cities where there has been a breakdown in the belief of the legitimacy of the police, or at least a questioning of the legitimacy of the police. Police are involved in all sorts of corruption. Whether or not the charges are true, millions of people have come to look at the police with a more jaded eye, and the corruption associated with payoffs and with drugs and with rapes and all sorts of things that you open the newspapers every day. To me, what is interesting about this is our cities are also plagued by a concern for criminality, a fear that I would say is very much parallel to what I'm looking at in mid-19th century Paris.
This kind of thing, for example, had not a major bearing, but it certainly played a role in the 1988 presidential campaigns.
Yes, I might even go a little further than that, Wayne, and say that it has had a major bearing, that uh-huh. that the political campaign of 1988 played very much on people's fears, and I think fears of criminality, fears of class, fear of race, that these issues of crime and race and class war in our cities were very much in the forefront of the political campaign of 1988.
And we got away from the notion of the police as a neutral, beneficial social force behind this large concept of law and order somehow or other.
Yes, well, the parallel that I began with and the one that your question, I think, pursues is that Paris in mid-19th century, the police were very much, I think, suspected in the same way that police may be in some of our major cities today, that people really didn't trust the police. If you read Balzac's novels in The Human Comedy, the police are the criminals as much as financiers and thieves are. Yeah. It's a society rife with criminality, and it's a society where the police don't work.
How did they end up being the good guys?
They end up being the good guys, I would say, less because of what's done with the institution and more in terms of what's going on in other parts of the society. Certainly recruitment and standards of behavior were enforced after mid-century. Another Napoleon, Napoleon III, in the 1850s set in place a whole series of reforms of the police because he realized that he himself had come to power through the breakdown of society. To me, the real interest in our own society of the late 1980s is why urban areas are stable. Paris in
as stable as they are, you mean?
Yes, as contained as they are. Why they don't blow apart?
Yeah.
Why, for example, why a revolution would not take place here as it did in France?
We saw some of that in the 60s, certainly in our large urban areas.
Yes, and that I think has much to do with the institution of the police. In the 60s, people came to question shared beliefs and shared values, at least the young did. If it was not a social phenomenon, it was certainly a generational one.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't happening today, in spite of the breakdown in policing structures and in spite of the problems of urban life, which I think many people have experienced, even if they don't live in big cities today. In spite of those problems, things are stable. Certainly within cities there's conflict, but it's contained. It's not something that threatens our national fabric.
Well, let me ask you to conclude on this note, Pat O'Brien. Are we just lucky? How do you explain this? I'm asking you to pursue this analogy between French and American history, policing structures.
I think this brings us back to the problem of a shared political culture. I don't think it's luck at all. I think it's a system of beliefs, a concern for a common set of values that we in the United States of the late 1980s have come to identify. A democratic culture that people believe in no matter what.
And there's a strong parallel to your description of French society.
Yes, and that was what was lacking, I would say, in France in the first half of the 19th century, and that's why you have a system of recurrent revolution, that those values had not been internalized. No matter how horrible the situation of urban life was, and I would say it was dramatically bad in 1848. The same kinds of things of crime, disease, the city as a pathological phenomenon is not so different from what we may say about urban life today, about the ghettos and about criminality. And yet things cohere in our society. So as a citizen of this culture, my own work makes me more aware, I think, of the elements of stability in the culture, but also the fragility of those elements. I don't see things blowing apart, but I marvel at the fact that they have not.
Patricia O'Brien teaches at the University of California at Irvine. During her fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Patricia O'Brien is at work on a study entitled The Police, the State, and Civil Society in 19th Century France. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Modern French History continues. My guest now is Donald Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During a recent fellowship year at the center, Donald Reed worked on a social history of France since 1880. Here is Donald Reed.
Well, I think I see the work I'm doing as not exactly a synthesis of traditional interests in history with politics, etc., and new social history, but rather as an attempt to say that both of them are fundamentally concerned with power and with the exercise of power, and with the exercise of power in a wide variety of locations, sites, maybe a wide variety of sites, of the family, marketplace, the state, none of which are totally separate. I am doing a project, writing a small book on the sewers and sewer men of Paris in the 19th and 20th centuries. And really it has two foci, both of which I think address some of these issues in social history as it's done today. The look at the sewer system itself is really an effort to ask, how did people deal with their own waste? I mean, what's people's relationship to that? And I think that in the 19th century until the mid-19th century in Paris, that waste was viewed very much as a threat to society. It was at once a cause of cholera, and also it was very much associated with political disorder. After all, where was Marat supposed to have spent his time during the French Revolution? We all know that he was supposed to have spent his time in the sewers, and the sewers were associated with political disorder. And then in the 1860s, under the Second Empire, the sewers were built to look the way they do today, and they were, in some sense, sanitized when it began. You could take a boat trip. You could, right until the 1960s, you could take a boat trip. You were hauled along by sewer men, and it became a place where people went, and you could have picnics and things like that took place in the sewers.
How absolutely strange.
And the point is there that people, that this was an example of technological progress, I think, and it's really one of the great examples of technocracy, of the state intervening in what was perceived as a serious social problem, one which had medical and political dimensions, and making it no longer seem like a problem.
So it's emblematic not only of an issue in public health, it's emblematic of a sort of an improving political structure in France, in 19th and 20th century France.
It's emblematic of a whole way of dealing with a social problem, that you can bring in engineers and that engineers will find the solution. And I think this is a particularly French idea, that where, for instance, today is nuclear power most developed, where breeder reactors most developed, it's in France. And the ultimate culmination of the rebuilding the sewer system is that instead of dumping this waste into the Seine, it was sent to irrigation fields outside of Paris where they grew vegetables which everyone praised and thought were the best vegetables in Paris. That, in other words, you could use even what had threatened society in a positive manner, which is exactly, for instance, what a breeder reactor is intended to do, to use nuclear waste in order to make more energy. So I say it is a very typically French project. But the question which interests me about the sewermen really is what they did in the late 19th and early 20th century. They were a group which received a number of social welfare benefits very early on compared to the rest of the French labor force. They were 100% unionized, very rare at the time. And won benefits for orphans and widows and for men who had to retire early because of injuries or illness. But what they did with those is what interests me. One imagines in a welfare system that benefits are given to people as individuals and they take them as individuals. But the sewermen as a group didn't look upon it that way. They felt that they had formed a group, they formed a family as they thought of it, and what they did is they formed a colony, what they called a colony, outside of Paris. They were given a big farm. And there, the orphans and the widows and the men who had to retire early because of illness or injury went to live together and reconstituted a family. How did they support themselves? Well, they supported themselves because they received these benefits as individuals. But instead of an orphan being sent out to live with a peasant family where they were generally maltreated as being just this extra source of income, they got to live within this, what they saw as a family group.
Now, there's a kind of a collectivity here.
Yes, there's a collectivity. And what I'm trying to use this to say is that this is an alternative way of dealing with a certain kind of state welfare system. And so that's an example of the kind of thing which interests me. I see it as an example of popular creativity. In other words, here we do not expect sewermen to be the source of new social progress.
Indeed not.
But in this case, I think what we see are sewermen who are dealing with the difficulties of a very difficult industry and finding an alternative solution.
Yeah, as you say, a kind of a social imaginativeness.
Yes, exactly.
couple of the key words that you're using, Don Reed, in the social history of France in the last 100 years or so. You talk about mediation and you talk about conflict.
What I think we're seeing, or what I'm trying to look at here in terms of conflicts and mediation, is to say that social groups within France are continually competing for resources, for access to the state, for control of the state, matters like that. And that the state, while it is at once dependent upon those groups, also plays a mediating role. It's very much through the state that groups of workers, peasants, etc., commercial people, whatever, go through the state and operate through the state. They operate through the state both as a political institution in its more limited sense, legislation, legislators, mm-hmm. etc. But even more, and what interests me the most, is through the state as an administrative apparatus.
Don Reed, we're talking about your social history of France, 1880, roughly up to the present moment. You use the expression public and private behaviors as you describe social history in France. Well, now, are you introducing the idea of private behavior, or are you trying to pull it into some sort of an equilibrium with what, I take it is more generally acceptable in the doing of history, i.e. public issues, public history?
Well, I see them as related, because I see precisely how were those private behaviors labeled as being undesirable, labeled as being deviant. They were done generally by authorities who hold public power.
Mm-hmm. So that you make me think of, is it Upton Sinclair or Sinclair Lewis, the American, one of the American novelists has a book called The Man Who Knew Coolidge, and then Vance Borghese later on in the 50s or 60s wrote a book called The Man Who Knew Kennedy. And what he's doing is playing with this idea of the tension, the disparity, the continuity between our public and our private behaviors. Now, does that trivialize what you are after, to introduce the idea of fiction as useful to a social historian?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, fiction has always been a way in which a lot of these private behaviors have been dealt with, and it's certainly for the 19th and 20th century, it provides some of our better records, let's say, mm-hmm. of private behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, private behaviors made public. To return to the labor inspectors group that I mentioned before, here I think you have a group which themselves have experienced many of these social changes that mm-hmm. I've been talking about.
Now, they're important, but they're sort of invisible at the same time, right?
Yes, they are. They are. I think that's a good way of describing them. They're very important, but they are not readily visible mm-hmm. group. And if you look at the labor inspectors today, the kind of people that, for instance, I've met and talked with, you find that quite a few of them became labor inspectors after the events of May 68. These were people who participated in the strikes in May 68 as students, were very influenced by that experience, and wanted to do something about it. The French government at that time, in its role as mediator and its role as intervener in society, decided that it needed to bolster the labor inspection system. It needed to increase the number of labor inspectors. When it opened up recruitment for labor inspectors, who was it who applied? Well, precisely people who had gone through the experiences of May 68, who had been very influenced by the radical currents of the time,
mm-hmm.
and they go on to become labor inspectors. And so you have a whole current through the 1970s into the 1980s of people who are on the political spectrum in France, very much to the left, who are also, though, working for the state. They are civil servants, and they are carrying out certain projects of the state, and those kind of tensions take place in their daily life.
We're talking about political conscience. Consciousness at a very general level, injecting itself into the French social system in a way, it just wasn't there before?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that even if a state administrator wants to carry out something, they can't carry it out just as they would like to do it. I suppose I'm paraphrasing Marx there.
Uh-huh.
That they need to use people. And that even the people that they use, in this case, bringing in labor inspectors, the kind of people who would be attracted to that job are not necessarily the kind of people that they would want carrying it out.
Uh-huh. Don Reed, does all of this amount to a very large word like progress? You historians, you gravitate to those terms, and yet you will instantly want to qualify them. Is that one of the items on your agenda here as you write this social history of France?
I think progress plays a role in what I'm doing, but not in the way that you've referred to it. I think progress plays a role in the sense that that is something that the French people, French society itself, came to think of itself as doing, especially after World War II, and in defining itself as being different than how it had been before World War II. So that progress plays a role, but not in the sense that the historian says there was progress between 1900 and 1980, but in saying the French themselves see there as having been progress.
That's a little too crude to look at it in that
But it's a historic it's a historical term.
Yeah.
It's a, I think France is a fascinating society, and I think to reduce it very much, you see a society which has both a clearly a strong state. I always think of this story told by a British, I think it was a British prime minister. Someone asked him, well, what's bureaucracy? And he said, that, my lady, is something they have in France. On the one hand, you have that kind of a system, and everyone who's been to France and had to stand in a line knows what this is about. But on the other hand, it's a land of people who at least think of themselves as being fiercely individualistic. Mm-hmm. And I suppose what interests me is what there is between that, because I'm very interested in how fiercely individualistic people in a state with a strong bureaucracy come together, how they form groups, and what they do about it.
Donald Reed teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Donald Reed worked on a social history of France since 1880. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 441. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about St. Patrick's Day and the patrician myth. My guest will be Monsignor Patrick J. Corrish of Maynooth College in Ireland. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in March marks an anniversary for the first of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's fireside radio chats, which occurred in 1933. The second week of March, 1888, marked one of the most devastating blizzards in U.S. history, leaving up to 50 inches of snow over the Northeast. Albert Einstein and Lucy Hobbs Taylor have birthdays during the second week in March. Einstein, the physicist known for his theory of relativity, was born in 1879. Taylor, the first American woman to earn a degree in dentistry, was born in 1833. Finally, the second week in March marks birthdays for James Madison, one of the architects of American independence, in 1751. And for Bayard Rustin, the civil rights leader and pacifist, who was born in 1910. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Above and below the streets of modern France, this week on Soundings. Listen for Patricia O'Brien of the University of California at Irvine and Donald Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Patricia O'Brien discusses her study of the police, the state, and civil society in 19th century France. Donald Reed talks about his social history of France since 1880. Modern French Society and Culture, this week on Soundings.